This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Looking for a job is lonely. Endless searching, phone calls that go nowhere, applications that vanish into thin air. What if you could link with dozens of local companies who are hiring right now with just one connection? That's Express Employment Professionals. Find us at expresspros.com. One connection, endless opportunities, and no fees ever for job seekers. Express Employment Professionals. Expresspros.com.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
What up? What's happening? Good morning, DMV. Hope you had a good weekend. Happy Cinco de Mayo to all of you out there in our nation's capital and beyond. If you're tapped in with us on the always free Odyssey app, welcome. If you're listening on your AM dial on the Team 980, welcome. If you're live on the Team 980's YouTube page, you see myself and Mad Max. Mad Max with a new look this morning. I'm digging it.
And why'd you have to bring it up?
You know, I did not say anything to you off air about if I was going to comment on your new look or not.
You didn't.
I love it.
By the way.
Fresh shirt coming in. Got the DOC on your shirt.
That's right,
love
baby.
To see it. We'll talk plenty about the burgundy and gold as we roll throughout the show this morning. Some massive news coming out of the White House. Unless you live under a rock, I'm sure you're already aware of what is expected to be announced. Has it already been announced? Has the meeting happened? Has the big orange man?
I don't know what the, because apparently the president has a press conference that's related to sports at 1 o'clock today.
Yeah.
But Axios has already put it out. Kimes already confirmed.
Oh, so it's not until 1. Okay. I thought I had saw that this wasn't set to get underway until 9 this morning. I thought it was a 9 a.m. thing. So it's not. Well, here's the news that we've been tap dancing around here. Massive news. Over the past couple of weeks, we've gotten some really good information in terms of RFK 2.0 and what is next for that land, what happens to it. We all know Josh Harris and company currently have a deal on the table that needs to be voted on, in which they're going to foot 76% of the bill. It would be the single largest public investment, rather, in D.C.'s history. It seems like the RFK 2.0 stuff is at the goal line, so to speak. This latest news that we're getting ready to give you acts almost as like a tush push for RFK 2.0. Because guess what? You don't get the NFL draft coming to the National Mall in 2027 without there being some sort of guarantee that RFK 2.0 is going to go through. Yes, I said it. The 2027 NFL draft set to take place right here in our nation's capital. Ladies and gentlemen, super duper excited about that. They're going to have it on the National Mall.
It's going to be sick. The view is going to be crazy.
Oh, I can only imagine.
It's going to be a lot like the Caps parade where they had the Capitol Dome in the background, but this time it's going to be the Washington Monument. It's going to be really, really cool. I'm excited. I think that the NFL has done a good job at using this 2027 draft as a little carrot.
Yes.
So I think that's going to get RFK pushed along quite well. Hopefully it's going to, you know, the NFL's going to be like, see how much money that we're going to bring to your city if you build this new stadium? You're going to make it back in a year, 2 years, maybe?
For sure. And I think the draft, first of all, if you got to watch this year's spectacle out at Lambeau in Green Bay, just absolutely awesome. Packer fans are some of the most loyal fans in all the NFL. And now that we're a winning team again, I can say that about you all. You all are some of the best fans in the National Football League as well. So I expect the National Mall to be on and popping. This is the thing about D.C. The last two weekends, right here in Navy Yard over at the bullpen, shout out our partners and pals at the bullpen, hosting just big-time banger parties after big-time banger parties. People come out when there's an event. Think about how we treat Wizard games, right? It's the Mo Gala, as I like to call it. Everybody puts their freshest outfits on, and you step out with your significant other, and you show to other people around the DMV what you got. The draft is going to be that on steroids. Are you kidding me? And the fact that it's going to be in April, now hopefully we, let's think about the DMV. April sometimes could feel like November, depending on which April you're in. Hopefully in 2027 we get warm weather. It's going to be awesome though, man. I can only imagine it. Think about it selfishly for us as media folks. Know what I'm doing in 2027? I'm covering the damn NFL draft, baby.
Know where I'm going to be.
You know what I'm saying? It's going to be super duper exciting. I wonder by that time, will Jaden Daniels have won an MVP or will he have won a Super Bowl? Then that's not like a call topic. What's more likely before the 2027 NFL draft comes right here to the DMV?
It's not bad.
It's not bad at all. I'm being a bad radio host. We're not actually going to take calls on that, but it was a good idea to bring up. But that is the big story from the weekend here locally. It was announced. First, I saw Axios on the scene, and then our guy John Keim, the most seasoned member of that Commanders beat, confirming those reports last night. The 2027 NFL draft coming to Washington, D.C., going to be at the National Mall. I haven't been to the National Mall before, and I know.
What?
Yeah, I know.
You haven't been to so many places that are like...
I know. I'm from Maryland or something.
Yeah. Well, it's required for like the DC experience, and I'm shocked that you...
I may have gone on a field trip.
I was going to say, like field trip or something to a museum.
Once upon a time, I may have gotten it in on a field trip at the National Mall. I had a very good friend, female friend, take some pictures there for her graduation.
Oh, that is a very popular spot.
Smashing pictures.
Very popular spot for graduation, prom, all that.
So speaking of prom, it is prom season, by the way.
That it is.
That's interesting, by the way.
Sure.
I have a whole prom story we can get into a little bit later on.
All right. Stay tuned, everybody.
In the show. But no, man, I'm just excited that we get to host a marquee big-time sporting event like this, man. I was thinking about it as I'm driving in. And we'll take your calls on this a little bit later on in the show. Like, is somebody out there who's older than me? You can call us at 301-230-0980. You can tweet at Team 980. You can tweet at NELL_BTP as well. What is the most, what's the biggest professional sport event, I guess, is what the question is, that we've had here in D.C.? I think the All-Star game in 2001 probably is that. I don't know whether or not anything else massive has come here. Caitlin Clark versus Angel Reese, very much like a thing. Well, no, that wasn't Caitlin Clark versus Angel Reese. The Mystics hosting Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese would go up there, I would assume. I don't know, man. I know maybe the All-Star game for baseball. We've hosted baseball All-Star game.
Yeah, 2018 All-Star game. That was a fun time out at the bullpen.
Yes, it was. We hosted All-Star game for Major League Baseball. I don't know if hockey's ever had, you know, All-Star weekend here in D.C.
I don't think they have.
I know the NBA has for sure. That's when the celebrities used to actually come out to All-Star weekend.
Yeah.
Before they started putting on this pity party that they do for ratings and money. Shout out ratings and money. We love them both.
They're great.
But it got me thinking, man. All of a sudden, and this is what happens. This is what happens when you get competent ownership pressing the buttons on things, man. This is what happens. You get to reap the benefits of being a major professional sports market. And it felt like for years on the football side, we didn't get to, you know, reap the benefits because of that rat-faced bastard, Dan Snyder. Shout out to our guy Denton Day, who coined the term rat-faced bastard when it comes to our guy Daniel Snyder. But speaking of ownership, because that's where I initially go with this, we'll take your calls on your reaction to the draft being in D.C. in 2027 a little bit later on in the show. But right now, I think it's a very appropriate time, guys, to sit back, have a minute, and really give credit where credit is due. I got Mike H. in the chat says, we're back. The NFL needed this marketing team to be you hit it right on the head. You segued me perfectly. Yes, that is what's most important here. We're back. Think about the blue blood franchises, the most recognizable franchises in all of professional sports. Yankees, Celtics, Lakers, Cowboys, Giants, Steelers, then Redskins was in that as well. So it is a really good day to know that finally the National Football League has kind of taken this dark cloud away from this franchise. For years, as a Commander fan, as a Washington Football fan, anytime you're engaging in conversation, yeah, walk around with an umbrella above you because it's a dirty, rainy parade that people are going to pour on you. And over the past 18 months, and Max, during the next break, we got to officially find the exact date that sale went through so I can say this properly. I've been trying to put it this way. I don't think I've ever watched a professional sports owner have a better 18 to 20 months on the job than we've seen with our guy Josh Harris. Starts off with a banger buying us all brewskis out of the bullpen. That was awesome. So he endeared himself with a fan base immediately. But when you think about the uniform upgrade, you think about
God willing.
Yeah, God willing. Well, I don't know if you saw that leaked helmet.
I did.
Face mask.
That was a very minor change that I wasn't super thrilled about.
Yeah.
Because, like, I want the stripe on the helmet to be back to the way it was, the yellow, white, yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And, sure, yellow face mask, that's fine. But, like, that just homage to the old uniform. Like, that uniform is probably one of the best in this town in probably...
And all the pro sports,
in
bro.
In the NFL.
It was a clean, sleek look, man.
Iconic. Like
yeah, for sure.
So.
I think that's the best way that I could describe it. Because I'll be real, at first, Mike H. says he wants the 91 uniforms. Exit the Matrix types in the chat and says, this draft revenue of $500 million now costs DC nothing for the infrastructure of RFK 2.0. That's a damn good point. Everybody's thinking here.
See? The carrot.
So I got Exit the Matrix. Exit the Matrix on in the YouTube chat says it's very smart for Bowser to do that. Does she get the credit for this? Or is this all three of these minds coming together?
She's parading around like she's going to get credit for it.
Well, what do we used to always talk about with Bowser with this? I knew she wanted to get this done. This is a legacy pull for her.
Absolutely.
As well. And I ain't mad at her. I ain't mad at her at all because I think in turn, right, we know the ancillary benefits that come along with a stadium development project, right? See Nats Park. And I think I was sitting in for Chris Russell last week when someone brought it to my attention. Mm-hmm. I wasn't even hit Mad Max. The learners ought to be a damn shame of themselves for not being willing to spend any cheese. That stadium don't even belong to them.
Yeah.
DC paid for all of that. And we still don't have a little bit of extra dough to kick out? Do better, learner family. We'll talk about the Nats a little bit later on. They took 2 out of 3 versus Cincinnati this weekend, and they're playing pretty damn good. A couple games over 500. Since that brutal opening week of the season. But the big news here this morning, set to be announced at around 1 p.m. Eastern time via an official announcement from Donald Trump at the White House. According to multiple different reports, the NFL is bringing the NFL draft right here to our nation's capital in 2027. It'll take place on the National Mall. Plenty of benefits that come with that. Our guy Exit the Matrix in the YouTube chat talks about the revenue that the draft is going to bring here to our nation's capital. Does that eat into some of the cost of RFK 2.0, some of the public funding that's being asked to be kicked out? Speaking of RFK 2.0 for just a second here, went on about this a lot over the weekend. We're at a point right now where, like I said to start the show, RFK 2.0 is at the goal line, so to speak. I think, you know, this draft news acts as a proverbial tush push, and we all know the success rate of the tush push. Let's just hope there's no Frankie Louvu coming over and hopping the damn line of scrimmage to stop this thing from happening. But I think, like you put it, Max, I love the way that you put it. It's a little carrot being dangled out there by the National Football League saying, hey, look, we're going to get you the draft. We'll get you a little extra money, but make sure through hell or high water that in 2030, that stadium's packed. We're probably going to host the Super Bowl champions. They probably break the rules for us.
That'd be nice.
Wouldn't it? But super excited about the NFL draft coming to our nation's capital. We'll talk about that more before we get out of this 10 o'clock hour. Big weekend around our nation's capital as well. Coming up in about 10 minutes or so, our pal John Walton, the play-by-play voice for your Washington Capitals, is going to join us right here on the Kevin Sheehan Show. I didn't even introduce myself. This is the Kevin Sheehan Show.
It is.
We are live and local on the Odyssey app. We're on YouTube as well. Kevin going to be back with you tomorrow. You all know who I am. You can see it on the YouTube chat as well. The youngest in charge, Linnell Willingham. I will take you up to 1 p.m. It was a big weekend, though. Like I mentioned, John Walton going to join us coming up at 10:30 to preview round number two of the Stanley Cup playoffs. It's going to be a chippy one. Caps, Hurricanes, two teams that don't like each other. If we rewind back to, I think it was March 8th, Max, when Connor McMichael hit the deck in brutal fashion.
I don't remember the exact date, but yes.
That was against Carolina.
It was against Carolina.
Then it led to my whole declaration of, hey, the hell with breaking that record up in New York. Come back home, do it against Carolina, a team that smacked you in the mouth a week prior. And we all know what happened since. But I expect this to be a very, very physical second-round series. To the credit of the Washington Capitals, and we'll ask John Walton about this in great detail when he joins us at about 10:25. Credit to the Washington Capitals for a group that was not playing their best hockey leading into the postseason. I think this was the type of series, and tell me if you agree, Max, that instills confidence back into your fan base that, hey, look, I know it's not something you want to rely on in professional sports, but the Caps have the old finger button is what I like to call it. They can flip the switch. They've officially shown that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say this about this team relative to, I guess, like 2018 is the low-hanging fruit.
Sure.
Not a whole lot of comparisons you can make. But I think this team's most dangerous weapon, their secret sauce, so to speak, is their ability to score in bunches. It feels like they're never out of a game because they can go rally off two and three goals in a period. We've seen them go through these lulls as well where they do struggle to score,
mm-hmm.
but the highs are much higher than the lows are low, is how I would describe it. The physicality of this series,
it's going to be
chippy.
It's going to be real chippy, and especially because it needs to be a chippy series for the Caps if they want to come out and win this series, yeah. Because Carolina, they've shown throughout the regular season that if you can out-muscle them, they got nothing on
them. They will. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're bullies.
Exactly. So the Caps have got to come out, be super physical, run up the hits, get them, hearing footsteps even when they're not there. So, and I'm hoping that Logan Thompson can keep this playoff run going because he's been lights out so far.
Yes, he has.
Credit to him, even after that injury where he was coming off the ice, not putting any weight on that leg in game three. That was super concerning. And then he just came back out and he's been lights out. The Canes, though,
yeah.
On the other side of it, they are Freddie Anderson, their starting goaltender, who mm-hmm. looks a little bit like me, is dealing with an injury. So they got Pyotr Kochetkov coming out in relief. And mm-hmm. so that might be a little bit something that the Caps can kind of capitalize on. We saw it with Montembeau getting subbed in for Dobesh. Montembeau, by the way, double groin pull.
That's disgusting.
That's tough. Horrible. I can't imagine walking.
Yeah, seriously. With two pulled groins. You probably could not walk. That's a freaky injury, if you ask me. You know what? The only thing I like about the Hurricanes is they have one of my favorite names to say in all of professional sports because I love my guy Sean McDonough, who does the NHL's play-by-play
on
ESPN. Sebastian Aho.
Yeah.
I love me some Sebastian Aho.
You know there are two Sebastian Ahos in the NHL?
So am I talking about the other one then that plays for
York? Does he still play for New York? It was New York and it was Carolina.
Because I remember, quick story, I was auditioning to be an anchor on CBS Sports Radio.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I had to do in my fill-in shift was, my audition shift was, do updates for a night. And Sebastian Aho was, and it was playoff time, and McDonough had a crazy call, and I was saying, uh-oh. But, yeah, you pick up what I'm putting down. So there are two dudes with the exact same name?
It's very fun. One.
That's ridiculous.
The one who plays in Carolina is Finnish. The other one who plays in New York is Swedish.
So I'm talking about the New York Sebastian Aho then.
No, Sebastian Aho The, there's, I think we're talking about the one in Carolina, right?
I think. So are there two or are there one? That's what I'm trying to pick up. Where does the other one play at?
New York.
And Carolina.
In Carolina.
We'll figure that out during the break. Because that is absolutely ludicrous.
It's very weird.
But there was a lot of hubbub over the weekend about, well, when is the schedule going to come out for Caps and Hurricanes? I'll be real with you, NHL. Why was it so difficult for you to create the schedule? This is a team with the second best record in hockey. Put their ass in prime time. That's it.
That's the thing. I really wanted the Blues to beat the Winnipeg Jets last night.
Because that would have allowed the Stanley Cup playoffs to go through D.C. as well, right?
Yeah. So game six, the NHL was like, if Winnipeg closes it out tonight, you guys will probably play Sunday night. So they would have played in the spot that game seven played in.
Yeah, right.
But since, you know, Blues forced game seven in a dominant fashion, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah. So now Caps playing Tuesday. It'll be a dogfight for the series, and I'm looking forward to it.
You know what a dog fight's made for? Doggy.
That's right, baby.
Brandon Duhamel, my guy.
That's right.
A lot more to get to. Here on the Kevin Sheehan Show, you're tapped into the youngest in charge, Linnell Willingham. I'm sitting in for a guy, Kevin. We'll take you up to 1 p.m. Eastern time before the cockle-doo-doo machine himself, Chris Russell, takes you from 1 to 4. A lot more to get to before we get out of here. The big news of the morning, the NFL draft coming to Washington, D.C. in 2027 on the National Mall. We'll touch on that before we get out of this opening hour as well. When we come back, though, the Caps talk continues. The play-by-play voice of your Washington Capitals, John Walton, joins us next to preview round number 2.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Life comes with big money questions. Is it better to max out your 401k or put more in a brokerage account? Does buying a home make financial sense in today's market? Should you use extra cash to pay off debt or invest? NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast has the answers. Their finance journalists break down investing and budgeting strategies to help you build wealth and navigate major financial decisions. Make smarter money moves. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Question for our listeners. Which automaker assembles the most vehicles in the country? Here's a hint. It's the same one that employs the most hourly workers in the country, and the answer is Ford. That's not a coincidence. It's a commitment. A commitment your local Ford stores share. And that is why Ford is now offering employee pricing across their full lineup of vehicles, which means you pay what they pay. So visit your local Ford stores today to take advantage of this great opportunity. Ford Motor Company. From America for America.
Optimize your nutrition this year with Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal service. Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved, ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from 40 weekly options across 8 dietary preferences like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Eat smarter at factormeals.com/listen50 and use code LISTEN50 for 50% off plus free shipping on your first box. Factormeals.com/listen50, code LISTEN50.
I'm Emma Greed, and I've spent the last 20 years building, running, and investing in some incredible businesses. The more success I've had, the more people started coming to me with questions. How do you start a business? How do you raise money? How do I bounce back from failure? On my new podcast, Aspire with Emma Greed, I'll be answering these questions and more through weekly conversations with the smartest minds out there. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Buck coming near side. And away from Mangiapane. Second unit here. Ovechkin. He scores. Alex Ovechkin has 894. And the bench empties here at Capital One Arena. Ovechkin has reached the summit. He needs one more to go one step beyond. He has tied Wayne Gretzky for the most all-time in NHL history.
Why did we come back with the game with the tying goal?
You know,
why not the tweet record said Chase breaker?
The tweet said 895, and I spent like 5 minutes scrolling through the files
love
looking
John's
for it.
John's call of 895. 894 was pretty good. John Walton is with us right now with the Caps and Carolina game one tonight at Capital One Arena at John Walton. PXP, play-by-play on X on Twitter. You know, I think I asked Joe B this on both of those goals. Did you prepare for those two moments as a play-by-play announcer? Did you know what you wanted to say? Did you have it scripted? Do we have John? Hello? I can't hear John.
Hello?
I got you now, John. Did you hear my question?
I did. I heard the whole thing. I'm not a scripted guy, but I will say, you know, with 894, with the one that was there just now, that it was, there wasn't anything there. I would be lying if I said that I didn't give at least some consideration on 895, because there is, it is this moment, you know what it's going to be. And there's so much in our sport that you don't know. Like when Kuznetsov scores against the Penguins in overtime, none of that is scripted, thought of. Even the end of winning in Vegas in Game 5, you don't know they're coming back from a goal in the third period. It could have been a blowout. You could have been pontificating for 2 hours. I mean, there's a lot of different ways a game can go, so I've never been a guy to script anything. I will say for 895, I had thought a little bit. One of my dad's favorite players was Hank Aaron, and there was a little bit of, I think, I never really quite know how it's going to come out until it actually happens, but I had at least kind of considered that morning. You know, when he hit 715, it was something that was similar to that, and that was by design, and that was for two reasons. One was for my dad, and the other was for my broadcasting hero, who I was fortunate enough to work with many, many years ago when I worked for the Reds, in Marty Brenneman. And Marty's first day on the job, which, if can you imagine this? Imagine what Joe or myself or you know, like Chris King with the Islanders or Kenny Albert, we all got to call it. Can you imagine your first day on the job? And for Marty Brenneman, his first day as voice of the Reds was opening day in 1974, and Hank Aaron hit 714 that day.
Wow.
An incredible, incredible thing. So it was a little bit of an homage to both of those guys that have meant so much to me, both personally and professionally. So I did, I do confess, there was a little bit of that in there. My dad has Alzheimer's now and, you know, doesn't remember a lot, and I wanted it to kind of be a little bit of a throwback to something that I know meant a lot to him. So usually the answer to that is absolutely not. But in that one case, you know, there was a little bit in there that I had kind of been thinking about that day I wanted to do.
Well, knowing that it will live forever, how did you feel about your call of 895?
I really liked it. You know, it's funny. You're never in a position. I always feel weird. You know, I mean, there are things that you do is like, okay, yeah, I think we nailed that one. We move on. But the ultimate judge isn't me. I mean, the ultimate judge is, you know, how it's received by the people who hear it. And I did hear from a lot of industry people and a lot of people that I know in this great game. And you know, you usually feel like, okay, I think that one lived up to the hype, lived up to the moment.
No, but it was great.
Ultimately, I don't think we picked that. I think whether you're Joe or whether you're me, you know, we serve up the best we know how, and we hope that it resonates correctly. And you know, I think for both of us, I think we were both pretty happy with that.
It was great. I think you both nailed it. By the way, I just looked this up because I wasn't sure. 715 Hank Aaron in April of 74 was called actually two ways. It was called by NBC, which carried the game live, by the great Kurt Gowdy, who was the voice of the AFL on NBC during the 70s. He was the host of American Sportsman, which was this incredible show during the 70s and 80s. But it was also, John, called by Vin Scully, who was the Dodgers announcer, and they were playing the Dodgers when he hit 715.
Two legends. I mean, right, so national, and a third, Milo Hamilton, and yes, there was, you know, so there were so many, and all three of the, I mean, just the best of the best of the best, even, you know, for the teams, because, I mean, like ours, right, you've got Joe and you've got me, but you had Kenny Albert, you had Chris King on Islanders Radio, right. So you had four different guys, but can you imagine having the star power and the magnitude of a call like that from the three guys you just said? I mean, it's staggering. Milo's was my favorite. That was the one that my dad liked the most, but you're right. I mean, having Vin Scully being able to call that it's not his team, right?
Right.
But that was kind of what Chris King with the Islanders got to do. And I talked with, when Chicago was in on Friday night, John Weideman does radio for the Hawks. And he said, listen, if it happens tonight, I said, I'm airing it out like it's the Stanley Cup. I said, I never thought I was going to be in a position to call this. He called 894. He got the call, the one that you let off the segment with, but unfortunately he didn't get that third one for the home folks. Otherwise, Johnny would have aired it out on Chicago radio, and that would have been fun too.
By the way, you mentioning Marty Brenneman's name, I'm certainly familiar with Marty Brenneman, legendary Cincinnati guy. But, you know, around here, for a few years, not a long period of time, he did ACC basketball games.
He sure did, yeah.
Yeah, and he was excellent.
North Carolina native, too. I mean, he's an East Coaster birth. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, big basketball guy. He did the Pacers for a while in the NBA for, you know, select TV games for them. He did ABA in Norfolk. I mean, he was, you know, very
Virginia
much.
Virginia Squires games in Norfolk?
Sure did.
Wow.
That was, yeah, and he did his last baseball job was Tidewater in Norfolk. So he was, there's a lot of Marty Brenneman folks down in Hampton Roads for sure. And then made the move to Cincinnati opening day 1974. And I worked with him. I was the PA announcer at Riverfront for 7 years, and I sat next to him. And I have never laughed harder in my life. He taught me so much about how I want my booth to be run. You know, we never take anything too seriously. My first day on the job, honestly, with the Reds, John McSherry, you might remember, home plate umpire, dropped dead on the field on opening day. That was my first day on the job.
Oh, my God.
So it was crazy. And I always have kind of taken the attitude from there. It's like, look, if everybody lives to the end of the day, we're all right here. Like, I mean, happens in his job that is it isn't fatal. So, like, let's move forward.
Exactly. That's not a bad attitude. You know, I don't know how big of a basketball fan you are, but you mentioning Norfolk, and they had an arena down there called the Scope, and the Virginia Squires played there, and the Virginia Squires had on the same team Dr. J and George the Iceman Gervin. They played together on the same ABA team in Virginia. That would have been probably the mid-70s, somewhere around there. Anyway, all right, let's talk hockey. So can you explain to me and to everybody listening why the odds makers don't like the Caps, you know, in this series and overall in the East and overall to win the Cup?
It's a great question, and I have, you know, old dog, new tricks. I try to pay attention to analytics and more modern numbers. We use more high danger chances. That's not a phrase that I have used in the broadcast until relatively recently in the last couple of years. There are things that can be quantified, and there are things that I just don't think can be. And the thing that I find very amusing about that in this series is that if you look at just straight analytics and Money Puck and all the websites, but you think the Caps shouldn't even show up. I mean, they have 67% chance of Carolina winning it, which is ridiculous. I'm not saying Carolina isn't going to win the series. They certainly could. They're very good. But the Caps are very good. To me, this is very even or relatively even all the way down the middle from goal to defense to forwards. It's going to be a fantastic best of seven. I do find it interesting, and the guys who always know a little bit more and always seem to get it a lot more closer to the mark are the guys involving betting lines and things that involve money. It's funny. Those are much closer. They edge Carolina, but just a little bit.
You're preaching to the choir on those people knowing what they're talking about. But I just looked. I mean, Carolina is on average about a -180 favorite in this series.
Yeah, they are favored. And I think that part of it is that they're a good puck possession team. And when you look, I mean, the Caps beat them twice in the regular season. I mean, it's not like it was lopsided in the regular year when they met. And, you know, there's a lot of hostility when they were in Norfolk. And remember the game with all the penalty minutes in the third period. So there's a lot of spice. You've got two really good goalies here. The one thing that Carolina does really well is they generate momentum off of virtually nothing, and they will possess the puck a lot when things are going well. Now, when they've been in D.C., it has not been as pronounced because they don't have last change. The Capitals have had trouble this season in Raleigh at times because when you don't have last change, and it should be mentioned here when people are looking at, oh, what happened in the regular season, I don't know how much they weigh that. I have not had a dinner in Raleigh in 3 years. And the reason is that for each of the last two seasons, the Capitals have gone to Raleigh on a back-to-back. So they have played in D.C., and then they had to get on a plane, and they go there, and they don't have a morning skate. They haven't had a night in the hotel the night before, like a dinner, rest, morning skate, all the routine things that they would do. they haven't done it in 3 years. And I'm not saying that that's a huge thing, but it is a thing when you are continually getting a Carolina team, and every time Carolina at least had 2 days rest and the Caps had none. This series is going to be close. It is going to be long. I think it's at least six. The Capitals need to win their home games for sure, because winning in Raleigh is very difficult. But that's what you play for home ice for. And I think as long as the Caps hold serve, I think they're going to be fine.
John, I had this conversation last week with, I think, Joe B and Tarek and a few others. Getting through this first series after they hadn't won a series since 2018, I don't know if you felt the same way, but it's I sense that a lot of people that are really into the team and are close to the team felt like there was some pressure building to not, you know, come up short of expectations, which would have meant, you know, getting beat in the first round by Montreal. They had a great season, a memorable season because of Ovi. So I'm not suggesting that this is icing on the cake beyond the first round, but do you think they're playing with a little less pressure moving forward after, you know, getting through, and not only getting through impressively in five games?
You know, it's funny, because if you look back over the last 15 years, and even in 2018, and we all remember Kuzi's goal against Pittsburgh, and we remember coming back from down 3-2 against Tampa Bay and winning in five against Vegas. But here's what sometimes maybe gets lost after 7 years. The Capitals trailed in every series.
Yeah.
They were down 0-2 to Columbus. They were down 2-1 to Pittsburgh at home. They were down 3-2 and looked like the dream was over against Tampa Bay, and they lost the first game against Vegas. They have remarkably this time, I talked with Tom Wilson about this a couple days ago, this remarkably was businesslike and really no drama. And the Caps historically have done nothing but drama. There was no drama here. And you were able to, and it was such a great feeling. And I even posted on X, Twitter, whatever we call it these days, the other night. I said, how great is it to be able to watch late round, first round games with your team already moved on? We haven't done that here ever. I mean, not my time. This is 14 years for me. Right. That's never happened. And it is, I think, a reflection of this coaching staff, these players, these vets, the new guys they've brought in, Logan Thompson for sure, to be able to say, look, we go out, we got a job to do. Montreal's a good team. And you know, the Caps were a better team. But at no point did the Caps, were you worried? I was never worried in that series. Like, I don't know if it's going to go five. I think they can finish this in five. And they did finish it in five. One bad game in game three, but corrected so well on the road and was just great at line matching, even when he didn't have last change, Spencer Carver in Montreal. So I think that's what you're going to see in this series against Carolina. I think that, you know, they may win, they may lose, but I think this is the biggest test for this team. If they get by Carolina, I absolutely believe this team can go all the way. It's a matter of staying healthy and all of that. They match up. They did very well against Toronto this year. They did very well against Florida this year. And they did very well against Edmonton. I mean, when you look at the teams on the other side, they won in Vegas in the regular season for the first time ever this year. So even the teams on the other side, they have generally fared well. They beat Dallas in October, which was a lifetime ago, but they have wins against everybody. There's no team they can't beat, but this will probably be their biggest test.
Yeah, the way you said that, there was never an opportunity for that feeling of dread and tension to sort of combine in a game six or a game seven. Now, the downside of it being over so quickly is we've had to wait nearly a week for game one, but it comes tonight. So tell me about the goalie matchup. You know, Logan Thompson playing at a very high level. Tell me about just the matchup between the two goaltenders in this series.
It's intriguing because both missed a little bit of time. Logan less because he left game three in the third period. And we thought when we didn't see him on the off day and Charlie Lindgren gave the long interview and they rope-a-doped us into thinking that Charlie was going to play. And then lo and behold, guess who comes out the morning of game four? Similar to that, Freddie Anderson got knocked out in game four, didn't finish the series. He is expected to go tonight. Freddie Anderson is a little fragile in terms of when he gets hurt, it seems like he gets hurt a lot, and he just can't stay healthy. Pyotr Kochetkov is our backup. He's very good, too. But when Anderson's been on his game, and boy, was he in the first round, gave New Jersey very little prior to injury. Kochetkov did enough to win and got him out of the first round in five games, too. They've had the same rest. Anderson should be good to go. Thompson gets a week here. Alexei Protas gets a week. Alex Ovechkin, old man week off is not terrible at 39, right? So right. I think there is some use, even though there could be some rust, and certainly that's a bit of a consideration for tonight. But both teams have it, so I don't know that, you know, there could be a little bit of a feeling out, but generally, as much as these teams don't like each other, I think that's going to really, the adrenaline's going to kick in. These guys are going to get after it right away, both teams. But for the goalies, Logan was one of the very best in the first round, won all four games, looked really good doing it, especially in the last two, didn't give them much at all, really. And I thought when he was called upon, and there were times, third period in game one and game two, the Capitals ended up winning game one in overtime, game two, but had to hang on to do it. This was a very close series, and he was definitely the difference. He'll need to be the difference again, no doubt. But against Freddie Anderson, I don't expect a lot of goals in this series. But we'll see. I think both these teams, you know, you negate the star power and you look at the Brandon Duhaime and those guys. Duhaime was huge in getting three goals in the last two games of the series against Montreal. Those are the guys to look to, but I think both goalies are going to be as advertised here.
If we fast forwarded, and I told you the Caps won this series in six or seven, other than outstanding goaltending, what would be the next biggest reason for them moving on?
Improved special teams. It was really one of the things, at least statistically. I know in talking with some of the guys in the room, I said, listen, yeah, they gave up five goals on a power play to Montreal, but it wasn't as bad as that indicated. And I said, okay, like I can buy that, but it still happened, and it can't happen, not against Carolina. And they are very good on the power play. So getting Alexei Protas back is huge for that. The penalty kill must rise to the occasion and really, first of all, don't give them a lot of chances, but when they're going to get some, make sure that you are killing as well as you know how and as well as you've done all year. And the power play, I thought, was okay. Ovechkin gets a couple of goals that way. They ended up with three. They were really quiet in the middle of the series on the power play. Better special teams on both sides of it. Not that they were horrendous, because they weren't, but statistically, you can't give these guys much. If you're giving them on special teams, if you lose the special teams battle, you will not win the series. I think even if it's close, even if it's even, that's okay. This team at 5-on-5 was dominant against Montreal, and I think they will do well at 5-on-5 against Carolina too. But don't open the door on special teams. Do that, and I think they're going to be okay.
Two quick ones to end. You know, in watching against Montreal, I'm not a guy watching a lot of hockey during the regular season. What was obvious to me is the Caps were just bigger, more physical, and Montreal was sort of top-line dependent on scoring. What will I notice more than anything else when it comes to watching Carolina?
I think the physical part is, you know, you think hitting and you think, you know, lining guys up and blowing them up, and you'll see some of that. But what I'm looking for tonight is Pierre-Luc Dubois' line, who was just terrific in shutting down, you know, the Caulfield line for the most part in the Montreal series. That line is going to get tasked. That's McMichael, that's Wilson, and that's Dubois. They're going to get a whole lot of Sebastian Aho and Andrei Svechnikov and Jackson Blake. That's their top line. They're very good. They're very skilled. They had an outstanding series against New Jersey. Devils just were blown out of the water by that line alone. Pierre-Luc Dubois only had two assists in the first round. He didn't have a goal. Makes zero difference to me, because maybe offense would be great, but the D-zone starts and what he was able to do defensively on that side of the puck to be able to limit those chances, limit those shots on goal. When you look up at the board tonight, you're looking for something to watch. Look what their shots on goal are at the end of the first period. If it's 15, that's a problem. If it's 6, that means things are going pretty well, and they're going to get their chances. But if the Dubois line is able to match and keep those guys to the outside, limit their multiple chances. They're a team that feeds off momentum, and when they don't have it, you can starve them out a little bit, especially when you have last change. But the shots are going to matter, because if they're getting those in-between-the-dots chances and following up with second opportunities, that means things are going poorly. But we didn't see a lot of that in the Montreal series, right, and hopefully that'll be the same here tonight.
All right, prediction?
Caps are going to win. It's going to go long. I really feel that this team is special. They did not get to the second round to fail. Carolina could easily beat them, and with the offense that they have and all the things I just said. But if Logan Thompson is a goalie that he was in the first round, if they get the offense that they have and they have gotten from guys like McMichael, now you get Protas back if he can contribute, if Ovechkin can continue to be able to get chances. I don't see this series going any less than six games. It's going to go long. There's going to be two trips to Raleigh here. You're going to have to withstand and maybe win a game on the road if you end up dropping one at home. Hopefully they don't. But I think in a long series, if you make the physical investment in the series early, make it hurt, and keep creating chances and be responsible defensively, Capitals can absolutely move on to the round of four.
I enjoyed this. Thanks. Have a great call tonight, John. Yeah, appreciate it.
Yeah, but you bet. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yep. John Walton, everybody. When we come back, Tush Push appears to be in trouble again. More on that next.
They're going to go. They're not going to use the timeout. Plenty of time here. It's Tatum. Robinson's on him. Tatum maneuvering.
Back-to-back 20-point leads blown. Knicks lead 2-0. Do they have to win Game 3? I kind of feel like they need to win on Saturday. Joining me right now, my friend Tim Legler. By the way, what's your next game? Do you have one of the games on Friday night?
I do not. I've got two games out in San Francisco, Saturday and Monday, Games 3 and 4 of the Minnesota Golden State Series.
With no Steph. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I played your sound yesterday about the way you felt about Game 1 in the Boston-New York series, called it an abomination, the way they played. What'd you think of last night?
Yeah, so look, I actually thought that the beginning of the game, it was clear to me their intent was to get into the paint, more particularly Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum. I thought both of those guys had a different approach. Derek White was probably the only guy that looked similar. You know, he's going to look – he's got a very quick release. He's a high-percentage three-point shooter. He's going to look for him. So I don't think he changed much. But I thought the other two guys looked different at the start of the game. And they weren't making threes, the ones that they did take. But I was happy, as just an analyst, watching them have better balance in their offense and not taking the very first open look they got. And they built a lead that way. Their defense was excellent. I was prepared to go on SVP after the game, and all the notes I was taking was leading me to a possession of them defensively, because I thought I saw some great things out of them there, and then a possession of turning down a three that led to something better in the paint. Like, this was going to be my two-play touchscreen. I took over 20 pages of notes on this game. And then all of a sudden, Kevin, here we go. And it wasn't like they started just completely, you know, taking threes the way they did in Game 1 that opened the door for the Knicks, because that's exactly what they did. By extending the game, they created more possessions in that game because of how quickly they were shooting the ball, right. And the Knicks needed all of that. That's not what happened last night. Last night, they only took three or four during that entire stretch when they were erasing that lead. They were getting into the paint. They were shooting mid-rangers. They had a couple plays at the rim. They just looked incredibly tight to me in everything that they were doing. So they were not able to convert, to stop the momentum. It only takes a basket or two, and they win the game in about a five-minute stretch. It was going to take two baskets probably to win the game, and they couldn't get it done. And I think the environment in the building for a home team in that situation, the shock that was probably being projected onto the court from the fans, I think it affected some of those guys. I think Tatum was affected by the narrative over the last 48 hours about all the threes they were taking, all the threes he was taking. I don't remember him hunting a single step back three in the entire game. He only took five for the night, and he takes 10 on average. And so I think he was really going overboard to try to prove to people that, like, he wasn't going to continue to go into this trap of just settling for three-point shots. And I think his mind was fried the entire night. That's what I think. And then in the fourth quarter, the pressure of the moment really just engulfed that entire team, where they couldn't operate normally offensively. And the Knicks smelled it, tasted it, and they were able to do the exact same thing they did to him in Game 1 and flip the script in a period of about 8 minutes.
Yeah, I described it as like the yips. I mean, it really looked like it. He that corner three that he had, he took his time and almost aimed it. You know, that's not the way shooters shoot it. You know, what's interesting about the way you described Game 1 versus Game 2. Game 1, like, would you have had an issue had they just not taken the volume of threes so quickly with the lead. If they had ultimately shortened the game, which I totally agree with you, they didn't do, and it's still, you know, shot, and they wouldn't have shot as many because there would have been fewer possessions, because it's kind of the, it is kind of the way they play yeah. to a certain degree. It was just different in game one because of how quickly they went.
No, that's really what the problem was, and people, you know, that heard my critique, I hope that's what they took from it, because that's what I was talking about. When I said it was insulting to the game of basketball, that's really what I meant. You know, the basketball gods are looking at them and like saying, you played a great game, you got a 20-point lead. Well, then the way basketball works, you don't, like, completely change your identity. It's not like you come up the floor and throw the ball into Al Horford in the post for the next 8 minutes. That's clearly not what they're going to do. This is their style. I get it. They've got a lot of guys that can shoot it. What I'm saying is, were they taking shots that quickly off of one pass? Or I had examples written down, and, you know, the funny thing is, it wasn't just Tatum, although he probably took five or six off-the-dribble step-back threes without anybody else touching the ball in that possession. I was actually more concerned with the couple of the ones Horford took, a couple of the ones Drew Holiday took. Drew Holiday ran down a long rebound in the corner right in front of the bench.
And just fired it up.
The opposing bench, and turned and fired a three with a guy draped on him as if it was the last play of the game and they were down by two. That's literally what it looked like, and it was almost. I made a joke last night. It almost got to the point. It looked like whoever makes one first wins a car. Like, that's what it looked like. Yeah. There was some sort of competition going on. That's how quick they were just letting them fly. Single crack of daylight, I'm letting it fly. And of course, according to Second Spectrum, which I have a lot of problems with, some of those are labeled uncontested. I would probably differ in that opinion. But the one thing that is not disputable is, you can have a shot that's rushed, even if it's uncontested. And they did that repeatedly, 37 threes after halftime. I mean, you've got to be kidding me. In a game you're controlling. So my problem wasn't necessarily the sheer volume, because they could have gotten threes at the end of those possessions too.
Right.
If once the ball hit the paint, and then kicked out, and they you know, they go around the horn a little bit. Like, that's when they're at their best, and you can't catch up to the ball, and they have too many guys that can shoot it, and that's when they just bury teams. But when they come down, and there's this shell that's never penetrated on the perimeter before they shoot the ball, when you're up 20, no, I think that is insulting to the game of basketball, because that's not how you win games. And that was my big problem with them. I don't think that was as much a problem in game two. They were actually, I think, thinking about it a little bit more. They still took 40, which is seven below their season average. It's going to still put them probably in the top 10 teams in the league in the regular season. So it's still a good number of threes. But to me, this was all about the pressure of the moment completely paralyzing them. And I mean that goes all the way from the players through the coaching staff, everything. And that's, I think, why Mazzulla didn't take that timeout at the end of the game, which is inexplicable to me, because I think he might have even felt the pressure and not knowing what to draw up. So let's just let him play. Let the players solve it. On a night when you're that bad offensively, Kevin, you can't walk home with a timeout in your pocket when you're taking your keys out and you're emptying your keys on your nightstand. Oh, there's a timeout in here. No, we can't do that. Not on a night they're that bad offensively. They needed you to take that off their plate and figure out something, inbounding the ball from half court with 12 seconds to go, that can potentially create the switch you want, create some sort of spacing to allow a guy maybe to get downhill in a one-point game, instead of just saying, oh, I'm just going to trust Jason Tatum because the last time we ran this, he got a dunk. So let's just go to it again.
That's what he was. That had to be what he was thinking, because when he didn't call the timeout, I think he was just thinking he could go coast to coast. That was just a defensive breakdown on the possession before, and they were ready for it with two players ready to stop the penetration when he got down there.
Well, listen. I was already very interested in that last sequence, right? Going into the post game with Scott last night. And then I became extremely interested as I'm sitting there listening to his post-game presser, Mazzulla, because he said exactly verbatim. He said, his first question, well, any consideration of taking a timeout right there? And he said, well, you know, we just got a great action off the last time we ran it, so we're just going to run it again. You know, I was hoping to get the same thing. And they covered it differently. Yeah, no kidding. The first time was an uncontested dunk by Tatum, which was really crazy to think a guy could go coast to coast and dunk the ball without
being
touched.
On that kind of a possession, yeah.
Yeah, it was a possession that important.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is there's still 20-something seconds left, 24 seconds left in the game when he did that. Okay, so the Knicks have plenty of time to respond to that. This last one, you're taking it out with 12 seconds. You really think the Knicks are going to let you do that again? No, they're going to lose the game if that happens. So he just should have, to me, anticipated something was going to be different. And the big difference was on the first one, Ananobi picked him up 75 feet up the floor, which allowed Horford to set that brush screen at half court. They got Ananobi off of him, and now Tatum's going 100 miles an hour at Mitchell Robinson, who's 35 feet from the basket. Yeah, he can blow right by him. The second time, as Tatum's coming up the floor, there's nobody in the picture. Like, everybody is back, and you can. I even froze it on the touchscreen. I did. Horford is trying to screen, and literally he's sandwiched up on one side Ananobi, on one side Robinson, but they're right at the three-point line. So, I stopped it and froze it as Tatum's crossing half court. There's still 9.8 seconds left, and Mazzulla's standing right up there by half court, right near an official. Like,
could have called the timeout there.
If that's what you thought it was going to look like, and you said that in your post-game presser, I got news for you. You should have identified as he's crossing half court. It doesn't look like that at all. Now, it's all kinds of traffic in there. Tatum has had a terrible night offensively. Maybe I should take a timeout right here. And we still have 9.5 seconds to run something constructive out of bounds. Kevin, think about this. How many times, honestly, do you watch games in the NBA, and at the end of a game, a star player, which both of those guys are, don't even get off either a shot attempt or a pass? It happened twice in a row to them. Jaylen Brown got the ball ripped out of his hands by Bridges in the first game. And last night, Tatum jumps in the air. He's swallowed up by two guys jumping at him. Brown is wide open on the wing, but Tatum had already committed to the shot, tries to throw a pass in the air, gets stolen. It's just so rare to see a star player not even get a desperation shot up on the backboard or make a pass to another guy and hopefully they can make a shot. They didn't even get a shot off in two game-winning situations in the playoffs. It's really
the time left on the inbounds in overtime in Game 1 was a lot less time. I think it was less than 3 seconds.
No, you're right.
But I totally agree with you. It's a guy
would get it up somehow. Like, I'm just, that's my point, though. Like,
right.
On that flare pass they threw to Brown,
exactly. You
know, normally, they're going to somehow, some way, they're going to get some desperation heave up at the rim. I mean, he just got the ball ripped right out of his hands. And then last night, of course, Tatum gets in the air and throws it away. And I froze it because I wanted to see how much time was left when Bridges made contact with the ball. It was over 3 seconds.
Yeah.
So you had Brown all alone on the wing. If somehow you can get that ball out of that to him, now who knows what happens, because he didn't have a very good night either, especially the second half. You know, he either shoots a three or maybe he takes a one dribble pull up 18 footer, but he's getting that shot off. But Tatum could not get the ball to him. And now here we go, man. We're sitting here. We just saw history. No team's ever blown two 20 point leads in a row in the playoffs. No team's ever come back from two 20 point leads. So I want to get
to some of the other series, but real quickly on this one, I said earlier in the show, it ain't over yet. I mean, I don't feel like it is. And I think Game 3 is really important for the Knicks to win. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. Totally. I agree with both of those statements. I don't think it's over. And I do think if the Knicks lose Game 3, particularly what I think the Celtics would have to look like to win that game, it would mean that they got back on track offensively. And they probably had some guys play well in the fourth quarter, because I don't think they're blowing the Knicks out. I think it's going to be a close game. If they win a close game and you got Tatum or Brown play well, or their team play well when they need to, they're going to feel like an absolute brand new team going into Game 4. So now you've got a real fight on your hands if you're the Knicks. Look, they've taken control. How much more control can you take winning two games on the road to start the series? I agree, it's not over. And I do think if the Knicks are going to get the Celtics' best game to this point in Game 3, sometimes when you can get away from the noise of your home crowd and the anxiety that's in the building in a tight situation like this, it might be the best thing for them to go play on the road right. and feel like an us against the world mentality rather than at home where every time somebody misses a three right now, there's a groan, a collective groan from 20,000 yep. people. Everybody feels it. On the road, you're not going to feel that. So I think it's the best thing that could happen to them. Go play in the Garden. It's going to be a wild, wild environment on Saturday afternoon. And the Knicks have a chance to absolutely put a stranglehold on this thing. If they lose, you're back into a situation, I think, headed for a very long series and potentially a game seven on the road.
All right. Let's shift out west. Do the Warriors up 1-0 in this series with Minnesota without Steph for at least, I think, the next two minimum, maybe three games. Does Golden State have a chance to win this series without Steph for three games?
I think unlikely to think they're going to win it. I think they'll hang. And I think I was thinking about it today. What could be likely is win a game while he's out, down 3-2, coming back to San Francisco for game six, Steph emerges. I think that's the shortest timeline for him. And I think that's probably the situation they would be in. I think they can get one. I don't know they can get more than that.
And I would certainly, if they got it to a seventh and deciding game with Steph healthy, I would give the Warriors a major chance.
I agree with that because they've managed those situations incredibly well. They've just managed one in the previous round. A couple of years ago, they went and won a game seven on the road against Sacramento in the first round. So they're used to that environment, and they've got – I think guys will step up and do what they have to do in that moment to make plays. The question is, their defense will keep him in it, I believe, over the next two, three games, whenever he's out. Can those other guys score enough without Curry on the floor? Because he creates so many opportunities for those role players because of his presence. You know, the Moses Moody's and the Pajemskis and the Buddy Hields of the world. What do those guys do against a very good defense to create their own offense? That's the big question.
You know what? I'm curious. I want to get to Denver, the Denver OKC series as well. But I thought Kerr the other night, the use of his bench after Steph was out, going as deep into places of his bench like Pat Spencer that he hadn't gone to, was fascinating. Were you able to make sense of it? It worked, but describe it from your standpoint.
Yeah, he didn't have a choice. I don't think I've ever seen a coaching staff more pressed as they're standing there watching that game thinking, please, one basket. Somebody give me one basket. And yeah. Buddy Hield actually was the guy that hit the biggest shot. He hit a corner three when that lead got down to 10. And it cut it in half, basically. And Buddy Hield hit a corner three. And I thought that was the biggest shot. You could almost see this collective sigh of relief when that ball went through. And so now they're thinking, okay, we're going to be able to hold on. Everybody looked more relaxed after that.
Denver wins game one. I've watched now all of Oklahoma City's postseason games. I think they're the best team, but they don't have the experience. But what do you think? Are they the best team, and will they win it all?
Well, I think Oklahoma City's been the best team in the league this year, the best team I've seen,
has played their best basketball. Oklahoma City's the best. Now, this is only their second time kind of going through this on this level. So they didn't handle it very well last year. Let's see how they handle it this year. But I do think now, particularly with the way Boston looks, Cleveland is obviously hanging on by a thread with all their injuries, down 0-2, going on the road. I think Oklahoma City is firmly in the driver's
seat. All right, you're jumping into your rental car or your car. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it. Good luck on the next two out in San Francisco. You're great on the broadcast. All right, talk to you. Tim Legler, everybody, calling in from wherever he was getting off a plane and getting into a car. Nice of him to do that. He's got the Warriors' next two games on Saturday night on ABC against Minnesota, and then on Monday night on ESPN against Minnesota as well. After tonight. Tonight is game two of that series. All right, that's it for the day. Caps tonight, back tomorrow. opener and another high-profile game coming up here in a couple of minutes. I did want to play one more soundbite from my conversation last month with Mike North. Mike is the VP of broadcast planning for the NFL and one of the key members of the NFL schedule-making team. I asked him about kind of the leaks that have, you know, sprung. I mean, there are Twitter accounts, websites dedicated to, you know, this NFL schedule release. It's become a bit of a cottage industry on its own. And in recent years, if you followed a lot of the leaks, most of them are actually inaccurate. And there was a big leak last night that many of you took and ran with. And it might be true. You know, I had multiple people in my life say, actually, this guy that leaked this, he's been right more than he's been wrong. But I want you to hear what Mike North said about the days leading up to the schedule release and all of the leaks that come out.
All well and good, and love that people care, and love that there's interest, but literally anybody who thinks they know anything about a game or the schedule or a team schedule is fake news. I mean, there's just literally nothing locked in yet. And oh, by the way, none of this gets approved until the boss says it's approved. So if we're looking at a, you know, May 13, 14, 15 or so time frame to release the schedule, kind of where we've been these last few years, right, second week in May, that means, you know, Monday morning the 12th, whatever that is, Monday, May 12th, we're in Commissioner Goodell's office, let the computers run all weekend, probably have a nice long Zoom call on Mother's Day night, everybody loves that, but then come in Monday morning with, here's some great options, Commish. Here's one that has Washington-Philly for kickoff. Here's one that has Detroit-Philly for kickoff. Here's one that has Denver-Philly for kickoff. They're all great. They're all slightly different, obviously. So it's not really like this one's better than that one. It's almost more like ice cream flavors at that point. Vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, they're all delicious, Commissioner. Got to pick one and put it out at some point. You give us another month, we'll find you a few more flavors. Here's a Rocky Road. Here's a Pralines and Cream. They're all great by that point, I hope. And I hope we've met with him enough along the way that we're not surprising him with anything. And those targets that he thinks we cannot miss on, you know, we've hit. So now it's just kind of on the margins. And is this one a little better for Washington? If so, it's a little worse for Philly. Is this one a little better for CBS? If so, it's a little worse for Fox. And just kind of try to find that balance, thread that needle, and pick a winner. Anybody who thinks they know what the commissioner is going to say is definitely, you know, not a chance.
There you go. That was from the horse's mouth, from the schedule makers themselves. They may not even have at this point it finalized until the commissioner looks at it. Sometimes it's the Monday morning after Mother's Day or Mother's Day night on a conference call. So take that for what it's worth. Doesn't mean that some of the leaks that have come out on the schedule, and there have been a few of them so far, the leaks that have come out have been some of the international games, and one of those is Washington at Miami, which many of you took and ran with as fact. I don't know that it is. I would imagine that there's, you know, a chance, and I will share with you what I think of that specific opportunity here in a moment. So I do this every year. It's kind of ridiculous, but it's a bit, and many of you like it. Many of you think it's stupid. I think, you know, it's something that I would do, whether I was doing it on the show or not. For nearly 20 years, I've been doing a mock Washington schedule. I'll have on my podcast tomorrow my entire mock schedule out, and I will then go through it on Monday on the show. But on the radio show today, I'm going to give you my mock season opener and another high-profile game. I was going to do it all on Monday, but the league announced yesterday that on Monday morning, they're going to start releasing some of the games. And unlike in previous years, more likely than not, Washington's going to be mentioned a couple of times officially before the actual schedule comes out in its entirety on Wednesday. So let's start with my mock season opener. So there's a lot about the schedule this year, and I'll repeat this on Monday. 17 games over 18 weeks. Everybody understands that. This is the year that the NFC plays 8 at home, 9 on the road. In considering Washington's, you know, season opener, 4 years in a row until last year, they had opened at home. 2020 Philadelphia, 2021 the Chargers, 2022 Jacksonville, 2023 Arizona. They had four straight home games in their season opener before last year switched to a road game at Tampa. I don't know that that's a big factor in the schedule creation. I just have a feeling that it'll even out a little bit. And so I think Washington opens up on the road. And part of it, too, is just looking at the Thursday night opportunity. Let me just tell you, I don't have Washington opening up at Philadelphia in the season opener on September 4th. I think there are bigger opportunities for Washington-Philadelphia times two this year, and the NFL schedule makers may see it that way. It would be a massive game. Don't get it, you know, a rematch of the NFC Championship game. Last year was a rematch of the AFC title game between Baltimore and KC. But Philadelphia's got a lot of possibilities that are really good at home and that don't necessarily use up a massive game for either Fox or NBC or, you know, potentially even, you know, Monday Night Football on ESPN ABC. I think Philadelphia is going to end up opening at home against somebody like the Rams, a rematch from that snow game. Maybe somebody like Chicago with Ben Johnson and his first game. I don't think it's going to be Washington. This is mock. This is a hunch. I just so everybody understands, I think the most I've ever gotten right is four, and then the second most I've ever gotten right is two, and that's only happened a couple of times. Getting one right is success. But I've got Washington still on opening weekend in a very high-profile spot. And I went back and forth with two potential opponents on Sunday Night Football, September 7th. You know, the biggest, you know, game in terms of the biggest audience size is Sunday night more than Monday night. Now, the Thursday night game will be massive, the opener. But again, I think that they will save Washington Philly times two for other high-profile spots because they can get away with putting almost anybody against Philadelphia on opening night and getting a massive audience. But I do think that Washington and Jaden Daniels open up on Sunday Night Football. And because I'm leaning more of a road game, because they had four home in a row before playing on the road last year, it was a choice between what would be an amazing Sunday night opener at Arrowhead against Patrick Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs, and a traditional staple high-profile game in the history of NFL schedule making, Washington and Dallas. I think Kansas City and Washington is a high-profile opportunity. I went with Dallas on the road Sunday Night Football for Washington's season opener. For one, Dallas has kind of, you know, occupied that Sunday night NBC spot on opening weekend many times over the years. Not every year, but more times than any other team. Washington and Dallas have played on Sunday Night Football a bunch against each other. Jaden Daniels, Washington at Dallas, Sunday Night Football, September 7th. That is my mock Washington season opening game. It was a coin flip between that and Kansas City, but I think Kansas City is going to be desired by a lot of the networks. You know, NBC for sure, and it doesn't mean that I won't have Washington at Kansas City in a Sunday night game later on in the season. But a Thursday night Washington, Kansas City, a Monday night, a Sunday afternoon 4:25 on CBS. I guarantee you CBS would love to have Washington and Kansas City as a high-profile, standalone doubleheader game at some point, maybe in November during sweeps period, rating sweeps period. I went with Dallas, Washington at Dallas, as my season opener on Sunday Night Football, September 7th. So that leads me to my other high-profile game. Now, I swear to you on my children that this was done yesterday before any leaks came out. And if I need proof of that, one of my very best friends in life will jump on and attest to it because I shared this with him yesterday in a conversation. Because he said, when do you do that dumb mock schedule bit that you do? And I said, actually, I just finished it. And he said, well, what were the big things? And I said, there was a big challenge for me between Madrid or Thanksgiving. To me, and we played the soundbite from Mike North last hour. Mike North from the NFL schedule making office suggested and implied that Washington more likely than not would not get Madrid and Thanksgiving. It would be an either or situation. Does that mean it's etched in stone? No. But I'm going to go with it and say that he was giving us a clue that it was either going to be Thanksgiving against the Cowboys. And by the way, Thanksgiving could mean the Thanksgiving night game as well against somebody else. But it was either going to be Thanksgiving or it was going to be Madrid. And to me, it was a Madrid and Christmas Day versus no Madrid, no Christmas Day, but Thanksgiving Day. And I went with swearing on my children that this was out before any of the leaks, and we don't even know if the leaks are true. I had mocked Washington to Madrid to face the Miami Dolphins on November 16th in a game that would start at 9:30 a.m. Eastern. In part because I really want it to be true, because I would love to go to that game. That's a game that I think I'm going to try to find a way to go to if I'm able to. There's no guarantee I can, but Madrid is a great city. They've never hosted an NFL game. And for the first game in Madrid to put Washington and Jaden Daniels in that city, that was a game that I mocked. Swear to God on my kids that I had mocked this before some people on the internet leaked it last night. And again, I played the Mike North soundbite because he said everything that comes out right now is fake news. So it may not even be true. But I went with it. I might be right. I might be wrong. But I mocked Washington to Madrid to face Miami, which means, based on my belief, based on what Mike North said, another clue as to what I'll have on my mock, that they're not playing on Thanksgiving, but they'll end up playing on Christmas Day. So there you go. At Dallas, Sunday Night Football, September 7th, as the season opener, and November 16th in Madrid against the Miami Dolphins, 9:30 a.m. Eastern. Those are the two games I'm giving out to you, but you've also learned that I'm not going to have them on Thanksgiving, but I am going to have them on Christmas Day in my mock schedule. I'm going to try to not pay attention to any of the leaks that come out. I promise you I will not alter my mock schedule to include any of the leaks, because I don't know that the leaks are true. And Mike North said, it's fake news. Nobody knows for sure until at least Monday when the commissioner comes in and puts his blessing on all of it. So there you go. Those are the two games. Now, something that we've done in the past, we'll do again. And I'm gonna focus on opening night and ask all of you, do you want Washington to open up on September 4th, Thursday night, kickoff game in Philadelphia against the defending champs? When they raise a banner or whatever they do, do you want that game or not? 301-230-0980, 301-230-0980. If you want to add anything else, you can get one other, you know, hunch or thing that you'd like to see on Washington's schedule. But that's it. I don't want your mock schedule. I don't want your four or five primetime games. I want a yes or no on whether or not you want Washington to open in the season opener at Philadelphia on Thursday Night Football, September 4th. Yes or no on that. And then you can give me one other thing that you'd like to see or one other hunch that you have.